The following program is brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice, and all economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal. Any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any person for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax, and penalties may be imposed on such persons, and each listener should seek advice from their own tax advisor, legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice. Nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show.
Good evening and welcome to Your Money with David Hayes. This is Doug Hughes live in studio on a brisk, windy, chilly Thursday evening. We're glad you're joining us tonight. We're going to have a great discussion. David Hayes is going to be calling in by phone. He's out in the Southwest, and we're going to have a great conversation. A lot to talk about today, dealing up with a lot of things that have been going on. But actually, this is the first show since the end of the first quarter. So we're going to talk about the end of the quarter. We're going to talk about some tax things. We just have an awful lot to go on the show today. Mr. David Hayes, are you out there?
Brother, I am here. I'm actually in the Valley of the Sun, which is in Phoenix, Arizona.
Nice.
You saw me at the office this morning. I had a client meeting. I was working on a bond portfolio with Eric, and then I casually went out the door, believing that I had plenty of time, Doug.
Yes.
In my mind, my flight left at 12:58. I don't know why 12:58, but that's what I thought. So I left the office at what I thought was a reasonable time. I get up to the airport, no problem. I'm walking through the airport gate into security, towards security. I pull out my ticket, and it says boarding 11:45, flight leaves at 12:15, and it was 12 o'clock.
Wow.
On the nose. So I fortunately had, I told my wife I credited it to good, clean living and only an occasional impure thought. Got me through security with no bumps, and I was able to get onto my Southwest flight and get here. And then I thought, well, I surely have two hours when I get here to get to the hotel, get set up, be ready for the show. I was all excited. I was doing tons of work on the airplane. The Wi-Fi was working. My email was working. It's all going great. I get to Phoenix Airport, and the line to the Alamo desk had to have been longer than the Beast line at Kings Island. It was terrible, like a 90-minute wait. So finally, wow. I was able to maneuver my way to the front, got my car, got to the hotel, got checked in, got to my room just in time for the show. So, Dougie, I'm here. I'm excited. It is the investment show. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about the first quarter. And really, we're going to be talking about GDP, because most of what people look to and look for is positive GDP growth. That's what's really driving the economy. We're going to reflect on fourth quarter GDP from 2015 and then kind of talk a little bit about these estimates that keep coming out and that keep getting revised and why that is and why you should look at all kinds of different factors. And then I think later in the show, actually, I think the next segment, we're going to be talking about how much stock should you really have in your retirement accounts. There was a great article in the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago, and I saved it because I wanted to talk about that on the show. So, Doug, looking forward to it. Very excited to be out here. Excited that you're there, back on the show live. And we'll
yes.
take a quick break, Doug, and we'll come back and we'll get right to it. How about that?
That sounds great. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. This is Doug Hughes live in studio. I am being joined on the line by Mr. David Hayes, who is down in Sun Valley in Phoenix. David, when we took a break there, you were just coming out talking about, I should say this, at the end of before the break, at the last segment, you were talking about GDP and what has kind of happened in the last couple of reports from GDP. Tell us what's on your mind.
Yeah, you know, and we wrote about this in the commentary, and you can get that at cfci.us, and we can send that out to you every 2 weeks. But, you know, last week's economic calendar, it highlighted the third estimate of fourth quarter 2015 economic growth. Now, the good news is it showed that growth was better than originally forecasted, by 1.4% up from 1. And then for all of 2015, the economy grew at a pretty respectable rate, about 2.4%. So that's not too shabby considering all the headwinds, of course, we faced down last year. So the revision reflected a little better consumer spending than originally thought, which is a relief to the recession watchers. And that's probably why we started to see that rally in the last few weeks of the month of March. And then they think, okay, that could bode well for the economy in 2016, too. Spending, of course, is being supported by a little stronger labor market, low gas prices. We're starting to see that finally trickle down through. But all the news isn't rosy because the other things we have to look at are things like business inventories. They were revised lower, pretty much showing that companies are pretty reluctant to tie up their cash in the face of uncertain demand. You know, if they don't know if people are going to buy their stuff, why are they going to make it? So the stockpiles are still pretty high. It's possible weak business spending will eat into economic growth in the first quarter of 2016. But going back to GDP, the real question is, you know, can you really trust GDP estimates? And the word is estimate. And it was brought up recently by a CNBC report that showed that GDP growth estimates could be off as much as 1.3% when they first get announced. And that wouldn't be a big deal if you had GDP of 7 or 8% like China's had, but when growth rates are already low, like 2.4, and if they're off as much as 1.3, that is a pretty large margin of error, and that can have some serious business for policymakers. So the question is, why can it be so off, or why are these estimates so off? Well, the reports used by federal economists to calculate GDP, they arrive months and even up to a year after the initial reports on economic growth go out. So they were forced to use estimates. Now, these reports come in, economists revise the data, and it's long after the relevant quarter even matters to most people. I mean, you know, if they're talking about fourth quarter GDP, you know, third revision, I mean, yeah, it kind of gave folks a little bit of hope that maybe 2016 could be okay. But that's one of the reasons why, Doug, you and I, Rod, Eric, all the guys, that's why all these folks out there trying to create models have to look at so many different indicators. They must understand the limitations of each one and not just look at one thing. I mentioned consumer spending. Our friend Mick Higley from By the Numbers had a piece this week that talks about the personal savings rate in the U.S. It's actually 5.4% as of the end of February 2016. It was only 1.9% back in 2005. Mm-hmm. So why is it 5.4% right now? If you've listened to this show for any length of time, we've been doing this for a long time, we've talked about this shift in demographics. And when people move into their 50s, they begin to spend less money. It's not that they're making less money. In fact, they're making more than they've ever made, but they're spending less because their kids now left the home. They're paying down debts. They're saving like wild people to try to prepare for retirement. And right now, again, according to Mick, 34% of the U.S. population, that's 323 million, are at least age 50. That comes right out of the Census Bureau. Wow. So when you see consumer spending was better than expected, and they talk about it being supported by a strong labor market, low gas prices, I mean, all that's true. But don't forget the big, big tsunami that you can't fight. And that's consumer spending with these folks that are in their 50s and 60s. It's just not happening. So continue to expect these low GDP numbers. Be grateful for even positive GDP numbers at all. I mean, when you look around the world right now, Doug, I hadn't actually looked at this for a while until I called into Glass in the Morning the other day. But the 10-year German Bund, it's basically like our 10-year bond, was yielding just over zero, 10 years. Yeah. And the Japanese bond, was actually negative. Yep. And then, so our 10-year bond at 1.7%, I mean, golly, that bond yield is going to be projecting what kind of growth is expected down the road. So we're still expecting growth in the U.S., not much, but obviously in Europe, in Japan, I mean, it's not just no growth. I mean, it's possibly deflationary growth. So that's one of the reasons the Fed has basically said, hey, don't expect any rate increases in the near future. Now, April's now off the table, it sounds like. Because how can the Fed continue? How can they tighten when everyone else is being so easy with their monetary policy? It'll strengthen the dollar. It'll kill things like the commodity rally we've had. It'll kill a lot of things. So the Fed has to understand this, and they know this. And I'm always baffled by the fact that these aren't, I mean, the things will come out one week, and all of a sudden the Fed will change their tune. I mean, I can't believe that these incredibly smart, bright people don't already know what's coming. So it's an interesting time we're in, Doug. And when you look at these bond yields, I know you look at those as well. It's pretty darn fascinating.
It is. It's and when you think just go back 10 years when you could have bought a 30-year bond or a 10-year bond and you'd be in the 4 to 6% range for a U.S. government bond, and you could put $100,000 in and you knew exactly what you're getting. And that the income has been cut in half. And I think what to the average investor out here is out buying bonds, what a yield, what is coupon, what do all these different definitions mean? The bottom line is this: when these interest rates have gone down and you go out and try to buy a bond to generate a certain amount of income, it's less than half of what it used to be, and no real signs of improvement coming on in the future. And that's happening literally around the world, even more so than it has happened here, to be down at just barely over zero or at even negative rates.
I learned this back in, 1988, 89, when I was following this guy named Charles J. Gibbons around. I was about 18, 19 years old. I went to these financial seminars that talked about equity markets and movements and interest rate cycles. And there's an investor decision line, and it's not set in stone, but there's at some point where people say, I'm not willing to accept this low of a return. And what they do, and sometimes unbeknownst to themselves, they take on more risk. They'll turn around and buy something like, you know, real estate, preferred, you know, common stock, and get out of these low-paying bonds. And that's what will support any kind of future market rally if, in fact, we still continue to have these low rates. I mean, it's a lot of things. It's not just one thing. There's a lot of things that have to underpin for you to see this. But we're seeing in the first week of the second quarter, the market's been pretty volatile so far. I think it was down almost 200 today on the Dow. And, so it's good. We're in a volatile time. People need to be prepared for that. And then when we come back, Doug, from this segment here, we'll talk about how much stock should you really have in your retirement account. Because when you think about it this way, the S&P 500, this comes from Mick Higley as well, gained 6.8% in March of 2016. Great month. But after losing 6.6% over the preceding 3 months, so December, January, and February. So since, you know, you're kind of back to where you were before they corrected before, and now we've got a little rough patch this week, you know, maybe it's a time to rethink how much equity you should have. Because if you didn't like December, January, and February, you may not like May, June, and July. I mean, you may not like it. Just because we've had this little bounce, don't think it's over. Volatility's here to stay. But let's talk about, Doug, when we come back, how much stock you should really consider having in your retirement accounts.
Great. This is Your Money with David Hayes. We'll be right back. The markets have been volatile 3 of the last 4 days. They've been negative 3 of the last 4 trading days. It's been an interesting start to the second quarter. Everyone's going to be getting their quarterly statements in the mail in the next couple of days. Happy with the ending of the first quarter and getting back to even. And now here we are sitting with the first week with some volatility. And we're going to talk about how much stock, and that's where the volatility has been, the stock market, how much stock should you have in your retirement account. Welcome back, David. Let's kick this
Thank
off.
You.
Now, I know the easy answer is, if it's the right one, a lot of it. But what happens to the person who doesn't have the right one?
it's been 7 years, you know, since the start of this bull market after we just got clobbered back in 2009, it's probably time for people to adjust their equity allocations in their retirement portfolios. But that's about where the consensus seems to end with financial advisors. You know, everyone's across the board on this. And, you know, we come from the school of thought of more of a purpose-driven approach than what I think a lot of people do. Because I hear, you know, we grew up in this business about caring about take 100 minus your age.
Yes.
That tells you how much stock you should have in your portfolio. So if you're 50, you take 100 minus 50, you should be 50-50 stocks and bonds. And remember what owning stock is. When you own stock, there's only two ways to invest. You either own or you loan. And we wrote about this in our book, Today's Guide to Retirement Planning, Chapter 6. It kicks it off. Owning and loaning. This is owning. When you own something, you take ownership of it. I mean, you got the good, you get the bad. You get the great, you get the poor. I mean, you get it all over the place. So that's really what owning stock is. So as most people get closer to needing the money, they'll start to shore up that portfolio, have a little less in stocks. But you have to remember, if you're 60, 65 years old and you're a married couple, the most recent statistics that came from Fidelity show that you have a pretty substantial chance that one of you are going to make it into your 90s. So you could literally be in retirement, you know, 30 years needing your money to last. You're probably not going to do it by sticking it under the mattress, sticking it in a CD at the bank or in a money market account. You're going to have some growth. And I've told people this lately that you almost have to, or I think you really have to, press the I believe button. You know, the old Staples button, the easy button. It's not easy for sure, but it's the I believe button. And I would tell people that what you should do is take it, sit down with someone and figure out how much money you're going to need. Now, that's always kind of challenging in and of itself, depending on how old you are. But if you're in your 50s and you're starting to get into your groove with your spending and you kind of know what your take-home pays are and, you know, and your kids are raised, you're not paying, you know, for school anymore, I mean, you can hone in on an income strategy, figure out what's coming in from Social Security, maybe have a little bit of a pension, and then boil down to how much you need to come from savings. Divide that number into, let's say, about 3%, just to be safe. That gives you some kind of a number to shoot for. Then you look at what you have now, what your savings are, do a pretty simple calculation with some reasonable interest rate. Don't go in there and say you're going to make 8, 10%. If you're sitting in a 50-50 portfolio, like Doug was talking about in the first segment or second segment, with low interest rates, maybe your bond portfolio is only going to return, you know, a couple percent. And most people are projecting with the slow growth that we talked about a few minutes ago, not stellar returns in the equity markets. So maybe you dial those down to 5 or 6%. If you're 50-50, you know, you're looking at 4, 4.5, 5% expectations for returns. That's what you probably should do, is put that number in and then see where you're going to be. Now, there's only a few things you can adjust. You can adjust your risk, which may give you more return, but certainly not assured. But two things you can control, Doug, you can control savings and you can control time. Mm-hmm. How much time are you going to work? Maybe it's 66 instead of 64. And Doug, I know you're all about that. You can control, basically do what you can control and then let the rest kind of take care of itself.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a few rules of thumb you have to live by when you are an investor. And that is, you know, when are you going to need it and how are you going to need it? So when we think about how you're going to be invested in stocks, one of the things you mentioned earlier, David, is a philosophy that has been in our office for several years, is purpose-driven portfolios or purposeful IRA distribution plans. And when we take, you know, this whole segment is about how much stock should you have. Well, let's drill down one step further and say what kind of stock, because stocks operate in different ways. You have growth stocks, and Rod's talked about this a lot, so I'm kind of rehashing here, but we have growth stocks that do not pay dividends. Rather than paying dividends to clients, they reinvest those dollars, and they are shooting for big returns. They're trying to come out with new products. They're trying to have a new place of business that they're buying, some real estate. They're just reinvesting all the time, whether it's warehouses or new land or new products or new lines to be able to produce their product. They're growing, growing, growing. Well, on the other side, you have dividend-paying stocks, and these are what we call value stocks. These are companies that take a portion of those earnings, and every quarter they pay out those in the form of a dividend. Now, when we talk about how much stock you should have in your retirement account, when we view someone who is younger and they are really aggressive, they may want more growth stocks, but most people want the power of dividend-paying stocks. And so when we look at retirees, for example, people 50, you've mentioned that number a couple times, people who are 50, they're looking for something that's going to pay a good dividend. So that is also a determinant how many or what percentage of stocks that you're going to own. Hopefully, if you are looking for income, you're able to find some high-quality dividend-paying stocks that pay dividends on a quarterly basis to help kind of do what we call growth and income, or income and growth. And you can control the type of stocks you buy by buying individual stocks or buying different vehicles that promote only dividend-paying equities or just growth equities. But when we talk about controlling the portfolio, as we move along and go down the track, we spend a lot of time talking about dividends, David, because they are a sign of health and they actually help with the overall total return in the portfolio.
And if you're an investor that primarily is in your 401k, you're not going to own individual stocks. But you can look at the funds and you can click them and you can see what they're investing in. And don't always judge a book by its cover, but you can usually start there. If you see equity income, it's probably a dividend-driven portfolio. If you see the word growth, then it's probably not a dividend strategy. And you probably should own a little bit of both. But going back to the purpose-driven real quick, take the amount of risk you need to take to get where you need to go. And then if that risk is comfortable to you, then you're fine. If the returns necessary to get you there a lot further or a lot higher than what you're comfortable with, then you're going to have to work longer. You're going to have to save more. I mean, there's only a few moving parts. And a lot of folks, Doug, are in these lifestyle or target date funds. And I could tell you, I had someone in last week that was in the 2015 fund. So you would think, gosh, money under the mattress, right? Well, when you peel that back, 50% of it was in stocks. Because,
yeah.
Again, if someone was expected to retire in the year 2015 and they're 65 years old, they maybe will have 3 years. So you can weather through a lot of rough markets if you have 50% of your money in fixed income, because you can take your income from that side of the equation if things get rough. And that's where I think that you've got to press the I believe button if you're an investor. At some point, you have to believe in the capital market for a long period of time will perform well. And then you need professional advice and money, of course, because I was a speaker.
All right, David, we're losing you there, so we're going to take to a quick break real quick. We'll be right back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back to Your Money with David Hayes. This is Doug Hughes live in studio. David, we kind of lost you as you faded out there at the end of the last sentence, but really what you were talking about is the fact that when you have a equity piece in your portfolio, that you're going to want to know exactly what you own and be wise about it and know what the risks are involved. And anything you'd like to wrap up with on that?
Well, I could have just run out of breath. I'm not really sure. But I switched over to the hotel phone, so we got rid of the cell phones, so we're back at it now. Yeah, we appreciate everyone taking the time to listen to the show. It is the investment show. Doug Hughes is there live in the studio anchoring down the desk. I'm in Phoenix at a due diligence meeting, which, Doug, I know you were at a due diligence meeting a week ago, and
yes.
What that basically means is that we're going out and kicking the tires or getting updates with investment companies that we either do business with or are thinking about doing business with. Last week you were in Boston, Doug, visiting with a company that we've done business with, gosh, since I started in the business.
Since we started, yeah.
94. So, you brought back some excellent reports there and still feel good about us using them. I'm actually out here kicking the tires of a brand new company that we've never used before. I'll do that in the morning. And then tomorrow afternoon I'm going to go visit with a client and do some actual retirement planning with her. She's thinking about retiring this year.
Well,
and then I'm going to go down south, and Angela's, our assistant Angela's Chambers, her brother, Nathan, who grew up, of course, right there in Bloomington, went to Edgewood High School. I actually coached Nathan in football and basketball back in the early 90s, but he and his wife live now here in Arizona, so I'm going to go have dinner with them tomorrow night. And they've been out here, and I'm sure it's a little bit lonely, so I'm going to go check in on them and make sure that everything's okay. But
yeah,
looking forward to that, and then I'll fly back on Saturday and be right back in the office on Monday morning. It's tax time. Of course, our office phones are ringing off the hook. CPAs, tax preparers are hard at work. But this year, you actually get a few extra days to prepare your tax returns in 2016. The deadline's April 18th, not the 15th. You can thank our dudes up in Washington for this gift, I guess. I'll need the extra time, I can assure you of that. Washington will celebrate Emancipation Day on April 15th, which typically that's on the 16th. That's the day President Abraham Lincoln signed into law a bill ending slavery, of course. April 16th falls on a Saturday, so Emancipation Day will be celebrated on the 15th, a Friday, and therefore pushing tax day all the way back to Monday, the 18th. So it doesn't mean you want to wait till the 18th to visit your tax preparer, but it'll give us that extra day or two, give us a weekend to kind of wrap things up. Of course, this information comes from a company called Tax Lounge, and we appreciated that. Pretty good stuff. I was given that information just as I was wrapping up the outline for the show this week, and I thought, you know what, that's probably good information for people to know. So if you're scrambling, you're thinking, I only have until next Friday, well, you don't. You have that weekend. So go ahead and procrastinate a little bit more. Go fishing, go mow your grass, do whatever you want. taxes, tax preparation, it's no fun. So, hey, Doug, the 18th. You have until the 18th.
Yeah, I know. We should also give a reminder out there to everyone, too, about IRA contributions.
Right.
That you'll have until April 18th to make those contributions to your IRA or your Roth IRA, and you want to have that postmarked before the 18th to the institution that you are making that deposit with. And David, what are the limits on IRAs this year?
Well, we can do up to $5,500 if you're under 50, and if you're over 50, you can throw an extra grand in there, make it $6,500. And don't forget, if you have a non-working spouse, you can make a contribution for them as well. So that's something a lot of people forget about. They can put money in. And, you know, some folks make too much money to contribute to an IRA and make it tax deductible. Some make too much money to make a Roth contribution. But don't forget, the backdoor method of making Roth contributions still exists. I know it's probably going to be eliminated at some point, but anyone can make a non-deductible IRA contribution and then immediately convert it to a Roth, because no matter what your income limit is, you can convert to a Roth IRA, pay no taxes on that, and you have the money in the Roth. You got to be careful, because if you have other IRA money, remember the IRS, and you've heard it on the show before, looks at all of your IRAs as one. So if you have $100,000 in an IRA and you try to do $5,000 into a non-deductible contribution IRA and then convert it to a Roth, only one-fifth of your conversion is going to be tax-free, because now you have $105,000 in IRA. So don't try to do the backdoor method into a Roth IRA alone. You definitely want some guidance and advice on that, Doug.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, we can't stress enough the value of the tool of the IRA account. One of the things that was really talked about, I guess maybe 8 or 10 years ago, was the Roth 401k. And what we've always encouraged people to do is to, if you're going to have a Roth 401k at work, get out there and open up a Roth IRA and get the five-year time frame started from the origination or the opening of the Roth IRA, and just have that thing sitting there, and then whenever the time is, you'll be able to roll that right into it. But IRAs, David, have been a really powerful tool for people to be able to save money on the side away from their retirement plan. And one of the things that you talked about earlier was when we were talking about individual stocks in that segment, is that if you're in a 401k, it's awfully hard to have individual stocks unless the company you work for issues or provides you the opportunity for individual stocks. But in your IRA, you are allowed to invest really in about any type of security that you would like. And so if someone wants to own some individual stocks, David, an IRA, whether it's Roth or traditional, is a way that people can do that.
Yeah, and a lot of times when we have clients that have 401ks and they're in the funds and things like that, we'll try to do complementary things in the IRA, stuff they can't do in their 401k. And some companies allow in-service transfers to an IRA. So even though you're still working, you can roll it into an IRA and open up the world to you. Most companies require you to be at least 59 and a half to do this. Sometimes they'll only let you take the money you've put in. Sometimes they don't have any restrictions. Some companies don't allow it at all. If you work for the federal government, you can certainly do it. If it works for the school systems, you can do it. Most companies allow it at 59 and a half. I was talking with someone about why you'd want to do that. Well, if you're 5 years from retirement, 59 and a half, you're 5 years away, let's say, now you can really roll that money out of the funds and put it into more purposeful investments. Eric and I were working on this laddered bond portfolio this morning for someone who's going to have bonds that will start maturing in 2020, 2021, 2022, and every time they mature, all the way out 10 years, for his first 10 years of retirement, have maturing bonds that are going to take care of his cash flow, and that allows him then to invest the equity side, the stock side now for 15 years, the 10 in retirement, the 5 until we get there. So it's a good thing to think about as in-service transfers. If you work for the federal government, you're only allowed to do it once. I think they put this rule in place across the board to allow people to take a little more control of their money as they come down the home stretch. So keep that in mind. But once again, you want to make sure you consult with someone that knows how to effectively do a rollover, because the worst thing that can happen is that check shows up in your mailbox and it's taxable to you. So, and I had this occur, and then we'll take a break, Doug. But years ago, I had a gentleman who kept saying, I'm going to retire, and then he wouldn't retire, and this happened for years, and then finally he said, I'm definitely going to retire. So I asked him, hey, do you need me to help you with this rollover? He said, no, my buddy just retired. He did. I think we've got it handled, no problem. I said, okay, well, here's how the check gets made payable and so on and so forth. Well, it was about December, and he calls me, and he says to me, uh-oh, I think I made a mistake. I think I checked the wrong box is actually what he said. So what happened? He said, well, I just got a check in the mail. He said, you know how my IRA, my 401k was worth $500,000? I just got a check in the mail for $400,000 payable to me, and they sent the IRS $100,000 of 20% withholding, and I don't know what to do. I said, well, the first thing we need to do is roll this $400,000 over to an IRA. Within 60 days, you can do it one time a year, and you're good. But that $100,000 that went to the IRS, we've got to figure out a way to get $100,000 into your IRA. Well, the IRS isn't going to send it back until you file your taxes next year. So we have to go borrow against the house. And that's what we had to do. We had to get a home equity line. We borrowed $100,000. We got it into the account, and we were able to do a full rollover and then do his taxes, get his full $100,000 back. It worked out okay, but what a pain.
Mm-hmm.
Had he not been able to get that $100,000 in, he would have paid taxes on that $100,000 that was tax money sent to the IRS as regular income. So he would have lost $30,000-$35,000 of that $100,000 by just checking the wrong box. So I can't emphasize enough that if you're going to do an in-service transfer, if you're going to retire and try to do a rollover, you don't want to mess this thing up. Sit down with someone that's done it hundreds and hundreds of times. So, Doug, let's take another break. When we come back, let's talk about questions of the week. We got some dandies this week. Hopefully we get through them all.
Great. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back to Your Money with David Hayes. Doug Hughes live in studio. David Hayes joining us by phone. David, before we get into the questions of the week, the rumor that has come around blooming today, I don't know if you've heard it about, is that Mr. Thomas Bryant will be returning for his sophomore year. So we want
let people know about that. I love that kid. I love OG. I love the Bryant. I mean, I loved our team this year, and boy, I'm excited about that. That's great news.
I'd like to see
quarterbacks over at the football team, someone emerge over there to be a star, and I hear Cameron's doing pretty well, so we'll have to see how that all shakes out. I'll buy my season tickets will be bought. The RV pass is anchored down, so whether we're 1-8 or 8-1, I'll be there.
Did you get a chance to watch the ball game the other night?
Which ball game?
The basketball game.
Oh, of course I did. In fact, I was not going to watch the men's final. I was just going to watch till halftime, and then go to bed. So I told my wife this. I said, I'm getting to bed early. But anyway, I thought I'll watch a few minutes into the second half, and I basically watched the entire thing. Of course, then I watched the women's game as well. I watched it until halftime, and I think UConn was up about 100. So I went to bed at that point. But
gotcha.
Yeah, it was a great week for college athletics. What a game that was.
Absolutely.
Only thing that could have made it better if the Hoosiers were in it.
That's exactly right. Well, hey, let's get to questions of the week, and I'll throw one at you. You ready?
Let's do it.
Okay. The question is, I have two IRAs and individual brokerage account, some money in the bank, life insurance, a house, and car. That's pretty much it. Quite a bit there. I was wondering if a trust made sense for me. A little bit more information. I have three kids and plan to leave it all equally to them and just don't want them to have to deal with a bunch of issues. What do you think?
Okay, well, you know, when people ask about a trust, I usually start off with, why do you want a trust? And they usually don't really know. In this case, it sounds like they just want to make sure it gets to the kids without a bunch of hassle. Well, you can do that with account registrations. In fact, IRAs do not get titled into the name of the trust. They have beneficiary forms. So you name them equally, three equally, and when you pass away within a few weeks, they'll have the accounts. So that's direct transfer. Money in the bank, you can make that pay on death. They call it a POD account. Again, just goes directly to them. Life insurance, as you mentioned, that has beneficiary forms. That's direct transfer. House in Indiana, you can actually put a transfer on death designation on your home and transfer it directly to the three kids. They'll probably end up selling it and dealing with it then. Brokerage accounts the same way. Cars, you can do that the same way. Then you'll end up having some other stuff. And then, you know, if it's under like $50,000, they can do a small estate affidavit and just blow it out, and it's not that big a deal. So I would say in your case, in this person's case, if they wanted a trust, it would be more to control how someone receives those money. So if one of the three kids was a spendthrift, maybe they wanted to control that that money a little bit from the grave, then a trust makes sense. But I would say you should always consult an estate planning attorney before making that important decision, Doug.
And David, also, one of the things that people commonly think about when they think trust is that if they put everything like they have listed here in a trust, that they're going to protect themselves against the nursing home.
Yeah, and it's just not the case. And they not, it doesn't save taxes and generally doesn't even save time. It does avoid probate, but everything I mentioned before avoids probate as well. So, so it depends. I mean, if you own, you know, a lot of maybe a lot of property, you know, again, have a kid that you don't think could handle the money all at once. I mean, there's some reasons to have a trust. But once again, once you sit down and kind of vent all that out, talk with someone who knows what they're doing, and they'll help you figure it out.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go to the next question. I'm leaving the NPERS system. I'm 58 with 17 years of service. What are my options?
So the Indiana retirement system, that's the NPERS system. In a couple weeks, Wayne Thacker and our own Ryan Belcher will be doing a show on this topic, people that work for the federal government, the state government. So here's the way it works. You can have full retirement if you're age 60 plus 15 years of service. That's full retirement. So one of the things you could do is wait a couple of years until you're 60. You could take a reduced benefit, but it's pretty substantial. Just by waiting 2 years, you get 100%. If you take it 2 years earlier, I mean, it whacks you pretty good. And then for other people, just so you know, there's this rule of 85, which allows if your age and your years of service equal 85, then you're eligible for full benefits as well. But, you know, some of these folks reach this at, you know, 58 or 60 years old, and they kind of forget that, hey, I have five more years until I can get Medicare. I have at least two more years until I can get on Social Security. So you got to remember that even though you can retire, maybe you don't always do it.
Right, exactly. And we've seen that where people just haven't sat down and thought the whole thing through, and they've charged on and
it's a long, you know, if you're 58 years old and pull the plug on work, it's a long time. It's a long, long time. We have a couple of young people that retired a few years ago, and you know, it's a long time. So you have to be careful and methodical, and you stay on top of things. If returns don't quite work out, you got to get on it quickly. So it's a long time. I mean, but the good thing about the NPERS system, they do have a pension. And
sure,
that's going to be there for the rest of their lives, which is a really good thing.
Okay, good deal. A couple more questions here, and these will be a little quicker, I'd say. What happens if I over-contribute to my retirement plan at work? Will they catch it, or do I need to stay on top of it?
Yeah, so some would say, what do you mean by over-contribute? Well, you can only put in $18,000 a year of your own money into a 401k or 403b plan. If you're over 50, it can be $24,000. So we do have people that will kind of front load that, and whether it's a good idea or not, I don't really have an opinion on that. But if you end up putting in more than $24,000, they will catch it. That's what they pay the administrator for, is to catch it. They don't catch it right away. It normally takes a couple paychecks, but then once they do, they'll kick that money back to you, and you'll be fine. Because there is an over-contribution penalty. Pretty substantial. I believe it's 25%. So of those funds that get put into an account, and that can be true with IRAs as well. So if you contribute more than you're supposed to, you better get in there and get it out.
Absolutely. Okay. What are the changes to Social Security this year? I've been reading about online. I'm not at Social Security age yet, but had planned to use one of the maximizing strategies I heard you speak about at a class at the library last year. What were those changes?
Yeah, and if you really want to hear a lot about it, go on to the WGCL Radio website and go back a few shows and listen to Mary Beth Franklin, who of course was on the show talking about this topic. She's the contributing editor of Investment News and the former editor of Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine, and this has been her area of expertise for as long as I've known her. But basically the way it worked is, used to work, if you were a full retirement age, let's say 66 years old, and you were married or had been married or were widowed, you could do a technique called file and suspend, or file and restrict, which meant that I was going to file, but I was going to restrict to my spouse's benefit. I was going to be entitled to 50% of what they are entitled to without affecting their benefit whatsoever. You did that to delay your benefit. Every year you delayed past full retirement, it increased by 8%, and at 70, it capped out, and you'd switch over and take this monster benefit forever. The spouse could file and take the money, or file and suspend, and both of you roll them up. I mean, it was a great strategy. I mean, just exploited the system like no one's business. In fact, when I would talk about the solvency of Social Security in these programs, and when we talk about these strategies, people would say, well, no wonder this thing's going broke. And we knew that there would be some changes, but we just didn't know it was going to happen so fast. So basically the rule is, if you aren't at least 66 by the end of this month, and your spouse wasn't 62 by at least the end of last year, then you cannot do that strategy of filing suspend or filing strict. So it's just a small group of people that can still do that. That doesn't mean you still should know what Social Security does, when it kicks in, what age you should take it. In fact, we were talking in the office, Doug, about maybe kicking back off some of these classes again that we taught last year at the library. So you might stay tuned.
Absolutely.
It'll be sometime probably in June or July before we have a chance to do it.
Gotcha. Okay, one last question for you, David. I just finished my taxes and owed a lot more than I thought. To your suggestion, I had 15% taken out for federal, 5% for state and local. On my IRA money I take each month, but still owed. My only other income is Social Security and my state pension. What happened?
Yeah, when you sign up for Social Security, there's not just an automatic prompt that says, do you want taxes taken out? You actually have to do something else to make that happen. So you probably had no taxes taken out on Social Security. And depending on your income level, 50 or up to 85% of your Social Security is taxable. So if none of that had any taxes withheld, that's probably one of them. The other thing, the state pension, and this is a little bit goofy, but when you fill out your W-4 for your state pension, they assume that's the only money you make. So if you're making, $1,200 a month, and they say, well, you only make 15 grand a year, and you put down, married with no exemptions, they're not going to withhold very much because they assume that's all you're making. So you'll have to beef that up a little bit. You have to beef up your Social Security. That's the root of the problem. It's not the money that came out of the IRA. That looks like they probably took out enough.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we need to move on to a break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Money with David Hayes. This is Doug Hughes. As we get ready to wrap up the show, we want to remind everyone and invite everyone to a special day that we have every year at Comprehensive Financial. This coming Thursday, April the 14th, we do our annual Shredding Day. If you have paper and documents that you would like to just bring by, we will have a shredding truck out in front of our office at 674 South College Avenue, again this Thursday from 2 to 5 o'clock, 674 South College Avenue, Comprehensive Financial Consultants Annual Shredding Day. David, are you there? Tell us what's on your mind.
Well, I was listening to the commercials, of course, in the break. And if you're listening on Saturday morning, the commercials always don't run the same, but there was a prostate commercial that was on, and I thought, I actually laughed out loud, and I thought, well, that tells us the demographics of the people listening to our show, the middle-aged men. They figured it out, folks. They're running ads directly to you.
Well, so they said 50 and above, so we're in good shape.
I thought that was great. Yeah. It actually made me laugh out loud, so I'm happy now. So
okay, great. Listen, David's going to be live in studio next week, everyone. Join us again. It's going to be a great one.
Brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.